FM, online, on your mobile, and on digital radio. Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
Global's newsroom at 9 o'clock. A British nurse who recovered from Ebola earlier this year is in a serious condition in hospital for treatment of an unusual late complication from the infection. Pauline Cathcart, who has flown from Glasgow to an isolation unit at the Royal Free in London this morning. Professor Andrew Easton, a virologist at Warwick University, says the virus can persist for some months, but more research is needed.
The numbers of people who have recovered have been small. They're in parts of the world where it hasn't been possible really to do the follow-up. But it's not unusual in virus infections to have a tiny proportion of infected individuals who keep the virus around for a little bit longer than the average.
The NHS says it's working to improve mental health care for new mothers after a woman jumped off a cliff with her four-day-old baby in Bristol. A coroner's ruled a series of failings contributed to the death of Charlotte Bevan, who had schizophrenia. She walked out of a hospital last December. Caroline Gamlin is from NHS England.
As a health community, we will act on the coroner's findings to ensure that mothers with mental health needs and their babies have access to the services and professionals they need to keep them and their babies safe during pregnancy and following their birth.
Authorities in Texas say one person's been killed in a shooting at a university in Houston. A spokesman for Texas Southern University says the campus was placed on lockdown and a possible suspect's being held. The police watchdog's been asked to investigate after a man who'd been handcuffed by officers last night in North London died in hospital. Scotland Yard said the man had become unwell while police were responding to reports of a robbery on Holloway Road. Labour says new figures released by health regulators show an NHS in crisis. NHS trusts in England have racked up a deficit approaching £1 billion in the first 3 months of the financial year. The overspend is being blamed in part on an over-reliance on expensive agency staff. Shadow Health Secretary Heidi Alexandra says it's no surprise.
I think, sadly, these figures confirm what many of us have feared for a long time, that NHS finances are in a dire and desperate state.
Organisers of an Oktoberfest event cancelled in East London say people need to contact them on how to get a refund. It's reported staff couldn't cope with huge crowds at the opening in Tobacco Dock in Wapping last night and they're now calling off the rest of the event for operational reasons. These people who'd hoped to go told LBC they're disappointed.
Absolutely furious, you know, it's just typical, goes to show the British can't do what the Germans do very well, which is, you know, organise a drink up in a brewery. And
luckily, Wapping has so many nice pubs, you find other ways to enjoy a pint of beer.
Entertain yourself.
LBC weather, a dry, clear night for London and the southeast, lows of 11 degrees. Northwest Scotland and Northern Ireland remaining cloudy with the odd shower, largely clear for Wales. And tomorrow, any mist clearing to leave a fine, dry day with sunny spells and highs of 17 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Katie Dartford.
This is LBC, leading Britain's conversation with Ollie Mann. Call 0345 6060973. Tweet at LBC. Text 84850. Ollie Mann on LBC.
Good evening, this is LBC with me, Ollie Mann, with you every Friday and Saturday night. Nick Abbott along in an hour's time. Until then, it is Friday, it is 9 o'clock, so it's time for LBC's Most Talked About, my weekly review of the very biggest stories of the past 7 days. Tonight with the Deputy Chairman of UKIP, Suzanne Evans, and Caroline Julian from the think tank Respublica. We've got a lot to discuss, the Tory party conference, Putin's ongoing intervention in Syria, Ebola back in the UK, and much else besides, and we'll take a first look at Saturday's newspapers as they land on my desk. You don't take your calls during this hour because we've got a lot to talk about with the panel, but I value your opinion. Text us as you listen. 84850. Welcome, Suzanne.
Hi.
Hello. Welcome, Caroline.
Hello.
First time are you, Caroline? Aren't you at all into this, in this environment with me?
It is first time.
Suzanne, I believe you've done the news panel back in the Ian Collins
but
days,
too,
but not with me.
It's a virgin Ollie moment for me.
There we go. Exciting already. Caroline, talking of virgin moments, Caroline Julian, head of policy programs at Respublica, looking through your Twitter feed, I learn you've never watched British Bake Off before this week.
No, I watched the final for the very first time. I was actually very addicted by the end of it. I was close to tears.
Are you a Bake Off fan, Suzanne?
I am. I've been watching it absolutely religiously. I love it.
How do you make it through the last 5 years without? I hate it, but how do you not know? How do you not have an opinion by now, Caroline?
I need to reconnect to popular culture. I think that's the problem.
But you found it gripping. I find all that tension and fake jeopardy about whether or not a bun's going to rise to be laughable.
Yeah, it's just, you know, baking is something that you get really passionate about, and when it doesn't turn out looking like the picture, it's absolutely devastating.
Well, I like you, Caroline, because my girlfriend was watching it, I had to watch a bit of it this week, and I did kind of get a bit into it by the end of it. And Suzanne, something that I learnt about you, you're known very much to LBC listeners as UKIP's deputy chairman, of course, but something I didn't know about you is that you run a charity, or founded a charity for people with lipedema.
That's right.
Tell me about that, because I don't know what that is.
Well, lipedema is something that usually manifests among women at puberty, and basically the bottom half of their body gets fatter and fatter, and there's absolutely nothing they can do about it. And I've got this condition, as has my mum, as has my daughter, as has my grandma, as my great aunt had. But it was something I only found out about 3 or 4 years ago, after years of being told I was overweight, that I was overeating, that I was lazy, that I was too fat, that my BMI was too high. And it's absolutely devastating, and I couldn't believe that this condition is actually incredibly common. We don't quite know how many women have it because it's so massively underdiagnosed, because people are always, you just think you're fat and there's nothing you can do about it. So we don't quite know how many women there are, but there are a lot, and I couldn't believe that there wasn't already a charity for it. So that's what I do when I'm not doing politics. I'm trying to raise awareness of this condition and try and research it and get funding to look into treatments and so on and so forth.
And so treatment rather than cure, I guess. I mean, what do you do for people?
There might ultimately be a cure. There's some genetic testing going on if they can find the gene that actually causes it. But unfortunately, it's proving not to be that easy. So there is no cure at the moment. And it is something that can get worse. It can potentially be disabling. But there are ways that you can treat it. And our philosophy at Lipedema UK is very much that if we can get doctors to recognise this condition when it starts, which, as I say, is usually at puberty, then instead of women going through the sort of horrors that I've had to go through over the last, 30 years or so, then there are ways to treat it and manage it and not have young girls absolutely beating themselves up about this.
Oh, well, good on you. Sounds like a great thing. Really, really interesting. I didn't know you did that as well. So there we go. Right. 84850. We're going to start talking about news and politics now. All right, I was just having a chat. We're going to talk about the news now. We're going to look back over the big stories of the last week. And here is a story that broke in the last few days, although reminds us of the nurse who came back from Africa all those months ago.
We know that patients who recover from Ebola virus do have long-term health problems after things like they can feel fatigued, they can have aches, and many of them also have visual problems.
That was Jonathan Ball, Professor of Molecular Virology, speaking to LBC. We're talking, of course, about the Scottish nurse who contracted Ebola in Sierra Leone last year, Pauline Kafaki. She's been readmitted to an isolation unit at the Royal Free Hospital. And in the papers today, Caroline, there were these photos of her meeting Samantha Cameron, being very close at an awards event. Mm. Health officials are insisting the risk to the public is low, but obviously the implication of that photo was, goodness me, the Prime Minister is sharing his home and his bed with someone who was in a room with someone who had Ebola just a few days ago.
Yes, yeah, well, what a wonderful kind of woman, sacrificing her life essentially to save others. But we have heard that this is highly precautionary, and that the general public are at a very low risk. I know that the Director of Public Health at the NHS Glasgow, Clyde, has been talking about the risk to the public as being very low. So I think we're absolutely kind of safe on that front. And actually the outlook for her is very good. I think Dr. Ben Newman said that she'd inherited a lucky set of genes.
Yeah, very good. Although Suzanne Evans, I mean, it was definitely portrayed to us in the press, wasn't it, that she's better. And then we hear her speaking just a few weeks ago about how her hair is falling out and she's still feeling sick and now she's back in hospital. So
in a way, perhaps the only good thing that comes out of this is it educates us all that Ebola is something very complicated that doesn't leave your body for a long time.
Absolutely. I think when the press report issues like this on health matters are particularly great, really quite frightening stories like the story involving Pauline Kafficke, then we obviously focus on the threat to the general public. We focus on the particular instance of that particular woman and as Caroline said, the great work that she's done. And I suppose that's the headline. And the small print is not so easy. It's not so not so newsworthy, I suppose, that in fact she might have these ongoing health problems. And I guess that's the problem that we have with the mass media. It is the soundbite, it is the headline, and the detail is not something that we go into too often unless, as in this particular case, it comes back to bite us, or in this case, Pauline.
And Caroline, I mean, I'm sure the vast majority of people agree with what you were saying about she did a great thing, she went to Sierra Leone to help out. There have been voices that have said, well, she chose to go there, she knew there was Ebola there, she got Ebola, and now we're paying for it. What do you say to the people who are listening who think that?
Well, I think she's a hero, and I think that we have to be reminded of that. And actually, every day people sacrifice their lives to save that of others, and I think we need to celebrate that and actually support it, even if that means supporting it economically.
Yes, I agree. Where would any country in this world be if we didn't have pioneering doctors who went out to deliver medical aid to countries where it's desperately needed? I think, you know, the work of people like Pauline, work of organisations like Médecins Sans Frontières, like the Red Cross, these people do an amazing work in some of the most difficult areas of the world, and all credit to them. We cannot blame them. And we in UKIP talk an awful lot about the foreign aid budget and how we think it's far too high. But I would absolutely want to see our foreign aid budget kept for extensive vaccination issues, for healthcare, for education in developing nations, and I think that is our duty as the fifth largest world economy.
Okay, well, I know lots of you listening will have a view on that. Let us know, 84850 to text in at any point during this hour. Let's talk about another story that's been making the news this week that really kicked off last week, and that is, of course, the Russian airstrikes in Syria.
By propping up Assad instead of defeating ISIL, Russia risks making a grave situation much worse. We want Russia to use its influence with Assad to find a diplomatic solution and help alleviate the humanitarian crisis.
Michael Fallon there, of course, saying Russia's aggressive behaviour is threatening our allies in Europe. The question is, though, Suzanne Evans, whether tactically Putin's kind of played a blinder here, because no one's going to go up against him and he's ensured his interests are maintained and there was a vacuum of political action or inaction.
Exactly right. And I have to say, you know, Michael Fallon, it's all very well to criticise Putin, but what was our strategy? We didn't seem to have a strategy at all. A couple of years ago, David Cameron was all out for fighting President Assad and giving money and arms and support to the Syrian rebels, some of whom have transformed themselves into Islamic State. So effectively, he was asking the British people to back intervention in Syria, which was going to actually give money to the very terrorists that we're now trying to get rid of. And are not just threatening people in Syria, but are threatening through their evangelical pursuit of this terrorist campaign all around the world. So Putin at least has an objective. And of course, Putin's relationship with Assad goes back many years. Syria and Russia have had a fairly friendly history over the last four decades or so. And Putin has decided, rightly or wrongly, that he knows which side he's going to take, but he's also trying to take out IS as well, from what we can gather. Whereas what was the British government's assessment? Well, they wanted to fight on two fronts. They wanted to fight Assad, and they wanted to fight Islamic State. Now, notwithstanding the fact that I think there's a whole question about the way in which we're far too easy to pay the world's policemen and intervene at all, the fact is, you can't have a realistic goal in a war, I don't think, to fight both sides in that war and to oppose both of them. And I absolutely agree with Michael Fallon, though, that we do need to make use of Putin's relationship with Assad to try and find diplomatic measures. Now, that might mean actually fighting IS on a united front. Perhaps even, trying to deal with the lesser of two evils, who might well be Assad. Not that he isn't an evil man, but as I said, he's not being evangelical in his terrorism. And ultimately, in the longer term, then look at a way in which power can be handed over and taken away from him.
And Caroline, Julian, could you imagine us then partnering with Putin when he is bolstering the butcher Assad, as Cameron puts it?
Well, I think, as Suzanne mentioned, we need to look at the objectives. And I think actually if partnering with Russia muddies those kind of objectives, we need to think again very carefully about how we go about working with those partners. But I think Suzanne's comments very much reflect Julian Lewis, who's the chair of the House of Commons Select Committee, Defence Select Committee, that actually we need a credible strategy. And actually we have neither at the moment, in terms of we can't pursue both goals in terms of destroying IS and also forcing President Assad out of office. And I think working strategically kind of across Europe is really the way to go. But Michael Fallon, the Defence Secretary, will really struggle, I think, in getting some kind of support in the House of Commons and House of Lords now.
What about Russia's that point? The support in the House of Commons, you're right, of course, he will struggle. Is that precedent wise? It was basically David Cameron that established this precedent that, you know, you go to the House of Commons to get a vote on whether or not you go to war. Every other Prime Minister ignored the House of Commons, not least Tony Blair, of course. Was that a mistake?
Well, I think it's important that we have that level of accountability. And actually the government now has to work harder to actually set out its strategy and to be clear on that. So that's the challenge for the government now, actually setting out a very clear strategy with very clear objectives and actually setting out the means by which they're going to achieve those objectives too.
And Suzanne, briefly if you can, do you think that the government should vote on action like this? It's the only way to make it legitimate?
Well, I suppose very cynically, I could say it doesn't matter because the government, the members of parliament voted against action in Syria previously. And I remember Karen very clearly standing up in the House of Commons and saying, I get it. And then what happened? We found out that they'd linked up with America and were engaging in airstrikes in Syria anyway.
Thank you for that.
Ollie Mann on LBC.
Yes, good evening. This is LBC and we're doing LBC's Most Talked About with me, Ollie Mann, Suzanne Evans, the UKIP Deputy Chair, and Caroline Julian, Head of Policy Programmes at the think tank Respublica. We're looking back over the week just gone by and also some front pages landing on my desk as well. Coming up after 9:30, we'll go through all of those and let you know the front pages of the Saturday papers before you hear them anywhere else. But yes, we are reviewing the big stories of the week. It's 84850 to join in with your thoughts. And inevitably, one of the big stories of the week, predictably, was the Tory party conference. There was the leadership speech, which we'll focus on in about 10 minutes' time, because actually, ever since David Cameron announced that he wasn't going to be fighting the next election as leader of the Tories, the focus of the media was very much on, well, everyone else.
It's difficult for schools and hospitals and core infrastructure like housing and transport to cope. And we know that for people in low-paid jobs, wages are forced down even further, while some people are forced out of work altogether.
So this is what our plan means. Attract a business and you attract more money. Regenerate a high street and you will reap the benefits. Grow your area and you'll grow your revenue too.
So it is unbelievable now to see that the Labour Party has been piratically captured in a kind of social media twitstorm by what Harold Wilson once called a small group of politically motivated men. And I know these people, my friends, some of them are out there today, actually. I know them. They are the London Labour Party. Trots and militants with vested interests and indeed interesting vests.
Boris Johnson there, of course, and before that George Osborne, and before that Theresa May, who used her speech to focus on immigration. And let's talk about that first of all. Suzanne Evans, she said there is no case in the national interest for immigration of the scale we have experienced. Is that right or wrong?
It's right. You know, I listened to Theresa May's speech and I just thought it could be Nigel Farage up there talking in high heels and with a woman's voice.
What a vision.
There's nothing that she said that UKIP has not been saying for the last, well, certainly for the last 10 years, really. And you think this is the Conservative Party that has attacked UKIP, has criticised it for talking about immigration, has said that we are wrong in immigration, and then, lo and behold, suddenly the Conservative Party comes up with exactly the same sort of stuff that UKIP's been talking about. We've been talking about the pressure on schools. Here in London, 35,000 primary school children not going to have a school place by 2020. Hospitals, the waiting list, you know, the NHS has been in the news today as well, massively overstretched, massively short of cash. Wages forced down. We were told that was wrong. No, you're lying, UKIP, you're lying. Don't say anything about that. We weren't lying. It's absolutely true. Finally, the Conservative Party is waking up. The big difference, of course, is that it's all very well for Theresa May to come out with this rhetoric and to talk about what's happening, but she can't do anything about it. Because as long as we stay in the European Union, we cannot control immigration from the other 27 member states.
And
so
from
if
that
Theresa
point of
really
view,
wants to do something, Theresa, come on over to the Leave side. Come on, come on, join us. You're very welcome. I'd love to campaign alongside you to get out.
And from that point of view, Caroline, I mean, agree or disagree with what Suzanne's just said, essentially supporting what Theresa May said, which is there is no case for immigration of this scale. She sort of shot herself in her own high-heeled foot, hasn't she? Because actually, indeed, you would conclude from what she said that perhaps the party you would go and support is UKIP because it necessitates leaving the European Union to really dramatically cut immigration.
Well, I think Theresa May could have actually carved a more unique line to UKIP on this, and that and we've had a lot of the discussion debate over the past few days about the numbers cited. So she cited numbers from OECD studies, but these have varied across a number of others as well, and it's all been about the numbers, it's all been about the pressures on infrastructure. Whereas I think the real story, and this came through in David Cameron's speech, is the social conservatism, is the compassionate conservatism. And actually I think within this topic we are missing that emotional debate. It's an emotional connection to people in their communities that this is really about.
Yeah, well, we'll talk a bit about David Cameron's speech after the news at 9:30, but you're right that Theresa May was almost talking at a different conference to everyone else. You know, she was striking a tone that was more UKIP-like when everyone else was striking a slightly more New Labour tone.
I think the party is very diverse, and I think actually there's a tension between those who are the kind of social reformers in the party, which are kind of David Cameron's lot, and those who are perhaps more to the kind of centre-right on some of these issues, and almost kind of halfway toward that social reform, as it were, but not quite there in the kind of emotional and passionate sense that I feel could underpin the kind of Conservative Party.
I think you have to remember, too, that as Home Secretary, Theresa May is clearly, in her department, seeing the impact firsthand of uncontrolled immigration. So she's the one that has to deal with the police, who are having to deal with extra people, more of us, meaning more of us committing crimes. She's the one that's having to oversee everything that's going wrong in the country. But I think what Caroline said is absolutely right. And I think one of the things that she did pick up that I was particularly keen on when she was talking about a cohesive society, and there are things that go beyond numbers, and there are things that go about beyond money. And people talk about, of course, immigration does, in many cases, bring economic value into the country. But what you cannot measure quite so easily is the lack of integration, the loss of British values, the change in our culture. And that is an emotional thing, and it's not actually that tangible to get hold of it. But we all know what it is when we see it, and we all get quite worried about it.
Because people have been arguing about the economics. I mean, here's an article from The Economist that I found reacting to Theresa May's speech. Says in 2001 to 2011, new immigrants from the European Economic Area contributed one-third more in revenues than they drew in public spending, subsidising native Britons. So if you have an argument about the economy, then you can say, well, actually, there is a case for immigration on the scale that we've had.
You can, but I've seen other studies that say exactly the opposite as well. And it really does depend how you count and what basis you start for. I mean, I don't know about that specific report that The Economist talk about, but for instance, there was another report that was very much in the headlines a couple of months ago. The report had assumed that every EU migrant coming into the country had already had the same average net wealth as people already living here. Now, clearly, that's not the case.
OK, 84850 for your views on that. Richard in Merton says Theresa May was giving vacuous rhetoric. She talks tough on immigration but has done absolutely nothing to control it in over 5 years as Home Secretary. I know you'll agree with that, Suzanne.
If I could just say, actually, I think that is a very interesting point that Richard makes. She cannot control EU migration, but the fact is this government has also failed spectacularly on migration from outside the European Union. So really, Richard is right. What on earth are they doing? It is just rhetoric.
Let's move on to George Osborne, because he probably generated fewer headlines, but he was talking about devolution powers. And Caroline, your colleague Philip Blond wrote the devolution policy that he spoke about this week, essentially. What is your involvement in that, and why do you think it's important?
Well, George Osborne called for the devolution of business rates to councils so that councils can actually keep the revenue that the new businesses bring in and adjust the rates accordingly. And this is something that we, Res Publica, called for back in March, and we're very pleased to see that now adopted. And I think actually this devolution revolution, if you like, is really the way to go in public policy. It is the kind of social reform that I think the Conservatives are rolling in. And actually, the devolution of business rates is really quite a radical move, I think, by the Chancellor, something that wasn't quite expected. We've seen the devolution of powers, for example, but not the kind of fiscal responsibilities alongside that, which we believe are needed for councils to be able to work alongside their public services and actually reform their local areas.
And what about Boris? Let's finally touch on Boris before the 12:30 news. He was the big story this time last year, wasn't he? You know, is he going to upstage David Cameron? Now he's got a majority, Cameron, that is. His feathers were a bit ruffled, like his hair, Suzanne. did he make an impression? Do you think he's still the more popular one out in the country as a potential leader?
I think he's very popular and he's a great performer. And I admire Boris in many respects. But you see, I think the problem that Boris has is that because he is this tousled-haired, happy-go-lucky, smiley, jolly, jokey chap, I wonder if he can actually get over that image and to take on a more statesman-like image, which will actually potentially propel him to be a possible leader the Labour Party, and I'm not sure he's able to do that.
Conservative Party.
What did I say?
You said the Labour Party.
Did I say the Labour Party?
they have moved.
I can't imagine Boris ever leading the Labour Party. That is completely beyond the bounds. So, but you see what I mean? You know, to lead the Conservative Party, to lead any political party, you have to be much more statesmanlike, and I'm not sure Boris has got that.
Yeah, I mean, this is the problem, Caroline. That's what people were saying 8 years ago when he was standing to be Mayor of London. He should be more statesmanlike in the public view now, shouldn't he?
Yes, but I thought he really communicated that through his speech, and then, although it's not quite there, I think he was the one who really struck the kind of hearts and minds of those in the conference centre. He was the only one who really inspired the level of standing ovation and applause at the end of his speech. So I think he's kind of getting there, and I wouldn't put it past him actually in the future of becoming future Conservative leader.
All right, 84850 for your view. Who do you think did best as the future Cameron? Was it May? Was it Osborne? Or was it Boris? You can tweet as well at LBC. Someone who calls themselves Flaming Idiot on Twitter, so they've done all the work for me, says the Tories stole UKIP's manifesto. UKIP got lambasted, but it's all right if the Tories say it. Hashtag hypocrites.
Here, here.
So there you are, supportive for you, Suzanne. Suzanne Evans and Caroline Julian joining me until 10. We're doing LBC's Most Talked About. Got the front pages of the papers here. We'll look at those in the next half an hour. Plus, after the news, we'll take a look at what David Cameron said at the Conservative Party conference. He is, after all, still the leader, you know. LBC News time, it's 9:30.
Ollie Mann on LBC.
Yes, this is LBC with me, Ollie Mann, with you through till 10. Nick Abbott along in 25 minutes' time. Until then, it is Friday night, so we're doing LBC's Most Talked About, my weekly review of all the biggest stories of the past week. I've got Suzanne Evans from UKIP here and Caroline Julian from Respublica, the think tank, and your texts and tweets as well. 84850 if you'd like to text in at LBC. If you would like to tweet, we'll bring you some of the more serious newspapers later, but the red tops are in. Daily Record in Scotland, obviously Scottish nurse, so Ebola nurse Pauline fights for life again is their headline north of the border. In the Daily Mirror, Viagra saved my unborn baby's life. Fascinating medical story. Sex drug boosts blood flow of tot who stopped growing, says the tabloid in the morning. Well, you have to buy the paper to see the details on that. We're talking about the Tory party conference. Before the break, we were talking about the potential upstagers, Theresa May, George Osborne, Boris Johnson. What about the main man himself and David Cameron's speech at the conference?
But there's another big social problem we need to fix. In politician speak, a lack of social mobility. In normal language, people unable to rise from the bottom to the top, or even from the middle to the top, because of their background.
David Cameron saying he believes the UK is on the brink of something special, setting out his vision of a greater Britain, promising to tackle poverty, lack of opportunity, discrimination, extremism. I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it, Suzanne Evans, that he gets a standing ovation and a round of applause now at a Tory party conference for making statements about racial equality and anti-homophobic policy, which even 10 years ago you'd have struggled to identify as a Conservative policy.
I don't know that is true, actually. I think the Conservative Party has, for all its other faults, has always been seen as the party of being of equality and social mobility. I think what struck me about Cameron's speech was that it just lacked any passion behind it. I watched it and I just thought, you're just going through the motions. There didn't seem to be any meaning behind it. I frequently said I feel David Cameron's all spin and no substance. And it just seemed to me that he was coming out with a range of sound bites that would send the party faithful crazy and they'd all stand up and cheer.
Well, you're describing every leader's party speech, aren't you?
I think I am, actually. There was something about this one, and I've watched David Cameron in the past, and I think he's been within the terms of his own party quite inspirational, but this, it just left me a little bit cold. There wasn't any passion, there didn't seem to be that much sincerity, and it was just like, right, we want to sort of talk about the middle ground, so what have we got that's middle ground that will get people excited? And he just came out with them one after the other, and it just felt all a little bit flat.
But that's, I mean, maybe this is just a Westminster bubble thing, but that's the interesting point, isn't it, Caroline Julian, that this is a Conservative Prime Minister firmly going for the centre ground, arguably some of the things he was saying left of centre, appealing to people who might have left Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party.
Absolutely. We heard terms like equality, opportunity, diversity, as you say, social reform, fairness. These are all kind of, this is all language of the moderate left. And I think we're seeing a little bit of kind of early Cameron here. So some of these terms were used in his first kind of speeches as Prime Minister. And he's going back to that kind of social reforming roots, which is quite nice to see, because we weren't sure where he was going on that kind of path as he was heading through the years of kind of Parliament and this government. So it's quite encouraging to kind of hear those terms again. But I think absolutely, I was speaking to some people just outside the conference centre who lived in Manchester, who said, you know what, I'll never vote for Labour again. I'm a working class person. I don't think Labour represents the working class. I do feel that the Conservatives now represent working people.
But you were saying, Suzanne, about the Tories being a party of social mobility. I mean, I know there's one way of looking at them which definitely, you know, endorses that, and you can say that they're at least colour blind, you know, and gender blind, and they had the first female leader and all of that. Nonetheless, if you're a working family who's having your tax credits taken away and you're not going to make as much money, then so what? You're going to listen to that and think, well, they're making me worse off. What's that got to do with social mobility?
It's a joke, isn't it? And I think the cuts that they've made, you know, have gone far too far. I think the introduction of the bedroom tax was one of, I mean, I know the Labour Party piloted it before that, but it was the Conservative Party that really brought it home. I'm sorry, no pun intended. And it was a disgraceful thing, and there's no doubt about it. If you are, say, a recent university graduate or someone who's in their 50s or 60s, who's been made unemployed, and you try and get a job, it is incredibly difficult. And both Cameron and Osborne in their speeches were talking about how people need to work, and this has been the rhetoric that we've had for the Conservative Party over the past 6 years. And it's just not possible. They do not understand. They just don't get how tough it is out there for people to actually find a job. And that, I think, is the thing that annoys me. But again, going back to social mobility, one of the ways in which they could improve social mobility, and one of the things that would be immensely popular in their own party, is to reinstate the grammar schools, to bring back grammar schools, to give poorer kids whose parents can't afford selection by house price, by buying a nice posh flat in the area close to the school, to give them an actual chance. But they have simply ruled it out.
Well, that's because they wanted free schools, isn't it? And they made a choice to endorse free schools.
That was the other interesting thing I thought about, Cara, you know, talking at the conference about free schools and academies. There's absolutely no evidence that free schools and academies do any better than schools that are taken out of local authority control. And again, I think it's just a sort of populist philosophy that really doesn't have any research or backing to it.
And Caroline, do you think on the tax credits issue that they're going to have to do some kind of U-turn or climb down on this? Boris Johnson was hinting in his speech that, you know, safeguards have to be in place for people on low incomes.
And we heard other Conservative MPs as well hinting at that. I think there will need to be some kind of taper to plug the gap between now and 2020. But even by 2020, as the Institute for Fiscal Studies has kind of revealed to us, the new living wage will still not kind of make up the cuts to tax credits there. So I think I agree with Suzanne on this, and that we need to be very careful about those who are right at the bottom, and even those who are kind of working families at present. We know that 200,000 children are at risk of being in poverty again because of these cuts. So I think the Conservative Party has a lot to work out there.
Okay, well, say what you like about David Cameron's lack of passion when he was talking about some of his policies. There was one moment where, undeniably, he got a standing ovation and there was some real passion displayed, and that is when he was talking about the Leader of the Opposition.
He thinks the death of Osama bin Laden was a tragedy. My friends, we cannot let that man inflict his security-threatening, terrorist-sympathising, Britain-hating ideology on this country we love.
Bit much, isn't it, Suzanne? I mean, you know, round of applause in the hall, but I mean...
I don't think it is, actually. I mean,
Jeremy Corbyn hates Britain.
He doesn't seem to be terribly keen on keeping Britain safe. He doesn't seem to be terribly keen on its security. I don't think he'd choose the friends that he did if he felt like that. The one thing I will say for him is I think David Cameron did very much misrepresent him when he talked about Osama bin Laden's death as being a tragedy. What Corbyn quite clearly said was that it was a tragedy. He was not brought to trial. And that is very different. And I think it was most unfair of David Cameron.
So you say he doesn't care about the defence of our country. You know, he says, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn's view is that the less we get involved in these international skirmishes and adventures, the safer we'll become as a country. So his motivation is to protect us.
It is.
He doesn't hate the country.
I'm afraid as
much. Might disagree with him.
As much as I wish we didn't live in a world where we had nuclear weapons, we do. And I don't think this world, or certainly our country, is not going to be a safer place if we get rid of them. I certainly won't wake up feeling any safer if we don't have Trident.
Do you think it's excusable, Caroline, for the Prime Minister to say the leader of the opposition hates Britain?
Well, I think it's rhetoric, isn't it? And I think Corbyn is in a very interesting position at the moment in that he is adding something really quite interesting and unique to politics at the moment. He's shaken up kind of Prime Minister's questions. He's not turning up to being sworn into the Privy Council because of other engagements. I think he's contributing...
because he doesn't want to have to kiss the Queen's hand. It's got nothing to do with other engagements.
So you think he doesn't want to kiss the Queen's hand. What do you think, Caroline? Right. Do you think it was other engagements?
Well, I think it's a mixture of... So it took Cameron 3 months to be sworn in because of the birth of his son, Elwyn. So we don't know what's going on in kind of Corbyn's life that...
But we know he's got time to turn up for the Tory party conference. And he hasn't got time to turn up to meet the Queen. I mean... He's been very consistent that he doesn't like the Queen, you know, nothing against her personally, but doesn't like the royal family. So, I mean, people, I think, out there in the real world, admire the fact that he sticks to his principles. Much as with your leader, Suzanne, people say of Nigel Farage, well, he says what he means what he says,
well,
I might not agree with
except
him.
Except he hasn't stuck to his principles, has he? He's actually backtracked on so much. He said he voted against staying in the European Union back in 1975, and he's been quite Eurosceptic. He's backed down on that.
Should he kiss the Queen's hand?
He said he didn't want to have anything to do with NATO. He's now backed down on that. And yes, he should kiss the Queen's hand, frankly.
But isn't that backing down on a principle?
Well, why back on that? Why back down on just about every other principle, but not that one?
Okay. Well, he has actually said he will go at a later date, hasn't he? He said he will. What happens afterwards will happen, he said, of whether or not he'd been proffered the monarch's fingers.
Well, and I think the fear of many Labour MPs is that actually all of these stories are distracting from the real issues, so child poverty, social mobility, tax credits that are going through at the moment. And that's the danger there. I think actually... He should be embracing actually some of these traditions and rolling with them, sticking with his principles, but thinking of other ways to gradually kind of implement those, but focusing on the issues that really matter to people.
Yeah, well, talking of an issue that really matters to people, and the Labour Party in particular should be making capital of this, the front of the I Weekend newspapers just landed on my desk. Their headline, NHS care at risk as cash crisis worsens. We'll be talking about that and the other front pages for Saturday morning as well. Next, it's 9:45.
Ollie Mann on LBC.
Yes, Ollie Mann here on LBC. Friday night, it's 10 to 10, which means you've just got 10 minutes till the early Christmas present that is Nick Abbott. He'll be here till 1 o'clock. At the moment, I'm doing LBC's Most Talked About. I've got Suzanne Evans here from UKIP and Caroline Julian from Respublica, the think tank. We're going to look at the front pages now of the Saturday papers. The I Weekend, NHS care at risk as cash crisis worsens. Staggering £1 billion extra debt in 3 months, it says. Worst financial position in a generation. Fears that hospitals will struggle in winter. And their sister paper, The Independent, as well on their Saturday edition. NHS faces £1 billion deficit after just 3 months. This is probably going to be the big story of tomorrow, isn't it, Suzanne? And it's a story that actually... has its genesis, obviously, in years gone by, but actually the statistics were out last week and no one seemed to notice before the Tory party conference, and now suddenly it's news. What's going on here?
Well, the NHS is clearly struggling. And, you know, bringing it back to immigration again, you cannot have 600,000 people coming into the country every year and not expect that the NHS is going to face problems in financial terms. It's not just that, of course. We're all living longer. And the longer we live, the more of us develop long-term conditions that need to be treated.
Some of whom are cared for by... people who have come over from other countries.
I'm not saying otherwise, but that's not the issue really.
When you say you can't have immigrants, you can't have mass migration and then have the NHS that we want. I mean, the NHS is only supported through mass migration.
Well, that's not true. And in fact, there are 80,000 British nurses who are turned down for training here. So maybe I'd say we should be looking at training some of the people that are already living in this country.
But that costs more, doesn't it?
It costs more. It might well do, but there's also another issue here. Another thing that I feel very passionately about. In fact, I was talking to a doctor who's been working in Uganda. When we take people to work in our NHS from other countries, we're actually stripping that country of precious resources in terms of their own health service as well. So people try and paint this debate as a very polarised one, and actually it's a lot more complex than that. But back to the NHS finances. I find it quite interesting that the Vote Leave campaign to leave the European Union that launched yesterday made quite a point in their launch video that we pay £350 million every week for our membership of the European Union. Now, that amount of money could completely build, finance and staff an entire new hospital. And I think there is a big issue here about where our money goes, how taxpayers' money is spent. And actually, I think I'd rather see that money put back into the NHS and help to erase this at £1 billion deficit.
OK, well, we'll come back to Europe in just a second, I suspect, when I read out what's on the front of the FT. But Caroline, just sticking with the NHS for a minute and moving it away, I guess, from immigration in Europe, are there other elements of this story that need talking about, do you think? If you work in the NHS and you hear that there's a £1 billion deficit, what does that mean? Because it carries on operating, doesn't it? No one's losing their job. It's just this financial hole, and the government aren't saying they're doing anything about it.
It does, and the Treasury has to then pick up the slack. But I think the missing story in all of this is that we're facing increasing pressures due to kind of long-term chronic illnesses. Mm. And it's we know that 1.9 million people in 2008 had long-term illnesses. That's going to rise to 2.9 million in 2018. So that's where the kind of increasing pressures are coming from. We're seeing lots more older people with far more kind of complex problems because medical care has developed and become much better over time. But that's, I think we found kind of that cuts to social care have increased those pressures on NHS services. And actually in a recent study, most kind of NHS leaders felt that was the case.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It is those cuts to social care. And particularly when you're talking about things like diabetes, dementia and depression, which are very often those sort of cases are picked up by social care in the past. Those three conditions alone, I've heard, could actually break the NHS within the next 5 years.
But I think things like devolution, again, could be a huge opportunity here. So we, ResPublica, called for the devolution of health and social care budgets to Manchester, which was implemented again in kind of Osborne's autumn statement last year. And I think cities have a huge opportunity to integrate those budgets and use them in a way that's most effective to the area to ensure that we really kind of care for the whole person, as Jeremy Hunt mentioned at one of our other events at Conservative Party Fringes, that we really care for that kind of whole person, for their whole needs, for their complex needs as well.
Well, the front page of The Guardian has just come in, and I think their headline actually hints at one of the other problems, of course, that the NHS is facing. Western diet fuels crisis in world obesity. 1 billion obese adults by 2025. Marketing by food firms blamed. And this story's literally just landed on my desk, Suzanne Evans. I don't know the details, but it seems from the headline that what they're saying is this isn't just about Britain. This is about the British and really American-style diet being exported all around the world through the forms of fast food restaurants and coffee shops and everything else, creating a problem in every country of the world.
Yeah, well, I think it is. You only have to look at the diet that we have now and compare it, for instance, with a diet in sort of post-war Britain. It's massively different. You've got this corn syrup in everything. I bought some coleslaw the other day. I looked at the label. It was full of sugar. But why do you need to put sugar in coleslaw? And food manufacturers are packing stuff in that's unhealthy, so salt, so sugar, so excess fats. And even when you think you're choosing healthy food, such as a low-fat option, if you look at the carbohydrate content, they've replaced that fat with something sweet and stickly, and the diet that we eat is clearly not healthy for many people, particularly not if you're living on fast food or pre-cooked meals. And one of the things I feel very strongly about is that we should be teaching nutrition and cookery in schools again, so people can actually make their own food using fresh vegetables, fruit and vegetables, meat, fish, whatever it might be, from scratch.
So education, the answer, not regulation,
so
not saying you can't sell these things with loads of corn syrup and sugar.
No, because once in a while they're not going to do you any harm. You know, you have one slice of chocolate cake even every week. It's not going to do you any harm.
What about marketing that to children though?
Well, I think actually, you know, there comes a point where you say, well, let's ban promoting everything. The cigarette ban hasn't stopped people smoking. It might have helped, but bans actually don't work in the long term. I think it is about education. I'm always shocked how many young people I meet really don't know how to cook. So we've had Bake Off, and I know Caroline's now catching up on Bake Off now, but I hope even something like that will give people the idea and the passion to start cooking for themselves again. And often, once you know what you're doing, it's just as quick and easy to make yourself a nutritious, healthy meal as it is to go to the shop, prick some holes in something and chuck it in the microwave.
Okay, I've got Suzanne Evans talking about obesity, and I'm going to ask Caroline Julian about Europe. How about that? It's the front page of the FT Weekend. Cameron woos Merkel amid fears hedge funds will back Brexit push. Now, don't worry, I won't expect you to be as across the detail as Suzanne would be, but this is a story about should we or should we not leave the EU. Chancellor urged to keep Britain in the EU, former M&S boss to chair the In campaign. Where is all of this at in your judgment now at ResPublica?
So I think my fear with the debate is that we're going to see it becoming increasingly polarised in a run-up to the referendum. And actually what we need to be thinking about is what is the nature of the European Union? What do we want it to do for us? What is our contribution? But what do we want to get from it as well? And I think thinking through a kind of strategy as to how we can constructively contribute to that conversation to actually reform Europe, perhaps from within, I would argue, would be a really important kind of move for us as a country.
All right, Suzanne Evans, you've got 1 minute, go for it.
Well, I think it's all very nice to think about reform. You cannot reform this behemoth. It is completely beyond reform. And when they were in debate in the European Parliament chamber in Strasbourg this week, President Hollande of France made it very clear. He said, look, you either go for full integration, so that's full political union, monetary and fiscal union, uniform tax rates, EU army, EU-wide police force, the whole kit and caboodle, he said, or you leave. That's their agenda. Reform isn't going to happen. What do we want Europe to do for us? Well, we wanted a common market that we were promised in 1975. We didn't get that. We're never going to get that. But you can trade very happily in the EU without being part of it.
OK, and talk us through the other side. Former M&S chief heads pro-EU campaign. What's that about and is there a threat there?
I don't think there's a threat there because on the Leave campaign we've got equally good.
But tell me about the M&S guy. I don't know about it. I really don't know that much about him.
I'll be honest.
Well, you must be talking about him.
I didn't know that. You've just told me about that. It's the first I've heard of it. But certainly, you know, on the outside there are people like Sir James Dyson, who's a very big name. You've got people like Rocco Forte, who are saying that if we leave the European Union, that's not going to affect his business at all. Lots of other people. Sir Digby Jones, big businessman, former head of the CBI, saying if we leave the European Union, we will have a free trade deal within 48 hours.
OK, Scottish Daily Mail here, they're covering the Ebola nurse as well. Of course, she's a Scot. Scots serious in isolation unit after relapse as parents express worry over victim's trip to primary only 24 hours before she fell ill. She was in a school, apparently. But again, you know, it's very easy to get hysterical about this, isn't it? And then look behind the headline and she is in isolation at the moment. The Telegraph also has a story, as far as I can see, about keeping sweets out of the hands of children, which perhaps deals with the obesity story we were discussing earlier. Just mop up a few of your texts. Social mobility says this one is the only, is only achievable through education, but the Tories won't allow grammar schools. Go figure.
You said exactly that, Suzanne.
But this text message doesn't agree with you, Suzanne. It says, Cameron's Tories, the new Labour Blairites, you, Ollie, and your guests are all essentially the same. You're running scared of the only real opposition, Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party. So there we are. He has a fan listening right now. That's it. Thank you. Suzanne Evans, pleasure to have you. Caroline as well, thank you for coming by and joining
in.
And giving up your Friday night from ResPublica. Don't forget, you can listen to LBC whenever you want. Just download the free LBC app for your mobile or tablet and never miss a thing. That's it from me, Ollie Mann. I'm back at 6 tomorrow, leading Britain's conversation at 1.